So the sites of coming resource wars, Middle East, next slide, West Africa, next slide, South America, and finally Central Asia. No great surprises there. Okay, next. So if we are to avoid resource wars, what are we going to have to do as a global community? Well, let's start with the U.S. What are we going to have to do? We're going to have to, among other things, find other sources of energy, because right now, petroleum, natural gas, and coal make up the lion's share of the energy that we use. let's take a look here. What's left? Nuclear electric power, wood and waste, hydroelectric power, and geothermal and other. Footnote. And the footnote says solar and wind. Next. Okay, let's look at this as a pie graph. Sorry, it's a little out of focus, a little difficult to see, but this little pie slice here, which represents between 6 and 7% of our total energy budget, that little slice is renewables. And if you expand that slice, you see that most of it is taken up with conventional hydroelectric power and wood, people heating their homes with wood, towns using burning municipal waste for energy, and then there's a little in the way of alcohol fuels and geothermal. And then wind makes up about 1%, and solar makes up about 1%. Now, we're not talking about 1% of the total energy pie. We're talking about 1% of this little slice. So if you add solar and wind together, currently we're getting 0.017% of our total energy budget from solar and wind combined. Now, why make a big deal out of that? Because solar and wind are two primary energy sources that we could grow. We can't grow hydroelectric production that much because we've already dammed most of the rivers. We're not going to burn a heck of a lot more trees because if we start doing that, then we'll run out pretty soon. Wood is renewable, but it's exhaustible. We can produce more power from solar and wind, but look where we're starting from. We would need to, well, think about this. If we were to double our total solar and wind capacity, what it is currently, what we've worked for 20 years to build up, if we were to double that, that's not a small feat. And then if we were to take that amount and double it again, we still wouldn't be up to 1% of our total national energy budget. So what's required in order to make that piece of the pie grow significantly is not just $1 billion here and there of seed money from the federal government. What's required is hundreds of billions of dollars a year in new investment. And the International Energy Agency acknowledges this. In their recent report, they're anticipating, in order to meet our energy demands by 2030, we're going to have to increase our investment in energy production dramatically to something like $550 billion a year globally, $16 trillion by 2030 we're going to have to spend. And that is assuming that most of that investment will go to fossil fuel resources. And that's assuming that those resources will be there to be found and developed. So if we were to follow the IEA path, which basically is echoed by the industry itself, I was at a presentation by an executive of ExxonMobil just a few weeks ago who basically showed the same graphs and same expectations of growth and investment and so on. By 2030, we'll be even more dependent on fossil fuels than we are now, and we will have spent $16 trillion to get there, and then what will we do? At that point, then we'll have to spend trillions more to develop an alternative renewable energy infrastructure to replace the fossil fuel infrastructure that's now obsolete because we've run out of oil and gas. It's insane. It's absolutely insane. And yet these are the responsible agencies telling us what we're about to do. Next slide, please. Is hydrogen the answer? I'm not terribly sanguine about hydrogen. I think it will have important niche applications. Hydrogen, of course, is not an energy source. It's a way of storing energy. It's a way of producing a potential transportation fuel from electrolysis using water, but you have to have lots of electricity. Yes, you can produce it using solar and wind, but you've got to have a lot of solar and wind production capacity installed to make much of a difference in that regard. Next slide. I'm not going to dwell on this very much, except to say that I think many people are under an illusion that hydrogen cars are just around the corner, and that in 10 years we'll all be driving them and we won't even notice the difference. We'll pull up to the same filling station where we're today, we're buying oil, and we'll just plug in and fill up the car with hydrogen. It's not going to be that easy. It's not going to be that simple. If there's no easy supply-side solution, and there isn't, it would take a fair amount of time for us to go through all of the available alternatives and see how, in fact, each of them would require immense investments in order to replace oil and natural gas, or in many cases, simply wouldn't be able to do so no matter how much we invested. Nuclear, for example, in order to replace oil and gas in this country, let's say just for transportation, how many new nuclear plants would we need? We have 103 right now. Well, it turns out we'd need about 1,000 more. Are we going to build 1,000 more nuclear plants when the cost overruns from the ones we've already built have practically bankrupted whole utility industries that have had to have been bailed out by taxpayers and so on? It's not likely that that's going to happen. So if we can't rely just on the supply side, we're going to have to look at the demand side of the equation, reduce our need for fossil fuels. How do we do that? Well, we have to look at where we're spending energy. This is just for transportation. Transportation is where we have to start because that's where we use the most oil, and that's where we're most dependent on oil. right now, we're using most of our oil to make gasoline to run personal passenger automobiles, and that's about the least efficient way of transporting ourselves that's ever been invented. Okay, a long-distance plane that's filled with passengers is more efficient than a passenger car, than regional train, long-distance bus, city bus. This slide is from France, by the way, so it has some alternatives not even available to us in this country. Commuting train, national train, Paris Metro, TGV, walking, and finally bicycle. Bicycle is the most efficient. But look at this tremendous range here. We are going to have to find our way down this slope and basically give up the automobile as a preferred means of transportation. It's not about finding alternative fuels for cars. It's not about developing hydrogen cars. It's about finding ways to do without cars. We have to do some energy triage here. You know, where are we likely to get the most significant savings from? Where are we spending our most energy? Well, it's all well and good to replace our incandescent light bulbs with compact fluorescents. Yeah, we should all do that. But look at the percentage of our energy usage that goes to home lighting. It's not the biggest energy sink in our lives by any means. Rather, home heating and driving and eating are the biggest ones. Those are the big three. So we have to find ways of reducing transportation, insulating our homes much, much better, and working with the sun, with heat sinks, with thermal mass, to reduce the amount of energy we use for home heating. And then we have to find ways of producing food using much less energy. We have developed a form of agriculture in the modern world that is so energy intensive, it's almost unbelievable. You know, if a coyote gets its energy from food, from running down, let's say, jackrabbits. And if it takes the coyote more energy to run down jackrabbits than it gets from eating the jackrabbits, the coyote dies, right? But in modern industrial agriculture, for every calorie of food that we eat, typically something like 400 to hundreds of calories of fossil fuel energy have gone to produce that calorie of food. Now, that's an energy imbalance that would be impossible under any other circumstances except for the temporary, one-time gift of fossil fuels. So we have to find ways of producing food organically without the giant tractors, and we have to find ways of transporting food far shorter distances. That means moving producers and consumers closer together. It means growing gardens in cities where the food is going to be consumed. It means the end of a 3,000-mile Caesar salad. It means the end of bananas in the middle of December in Toronto. Now, what we actually need to do is pull together on a World War II level basis. And we have shown that we can do this. People are extraordinarily cooperative if they understand that they are under threat, if they understand that their collective efforts will make a difference. People can do amazing things. Back in World War II, you couldn't just go into any department store and buy nylon stockings or new tires for your car or even new gasoline for your car. These things were rationed, but people were willing to go along with that because they understood how important this was. They understood if they worked together, they could accomplish something important. People started growing victory gardens on golf courses, front lawns, tearing up pavement to grow gardens. And by the way, this was not a government program. It started with ordinary people, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture tried to suppress the victory gardens. But finally, after it became clear that they couldn't suppress the movement, the USDA decided to take credit for it. All of this we can do again. It's going to need some good leadership, and it's going to need some people out ahead of the curve who understand how to do these things in their lives, how to build more energy-efficient houses, how to grow their own food, and so on, so that they can teach others. Next slide. Overall, our options are pretty easy to enumerate. We can fight for the last drop. Next slide. We can wait for a techno fix, and that's going to lead us right back to plan A, because the techno fix is likely not to arrive, and if we don't have anything better under development, we'll end up just fighting for what's left. Next slide. Don't worry, technology will save you. Yes, next slide. Or we can address the underlying ecological dilemma. See, all of this that we've been talking about as related to fossil fuels is really just an expression of a universal, timeless problem that we humans have faced as long as we've been on the planet, and in fact that every species has faced. Next slide. And that is the problem of resource depletion, habitat destruction, and population pressure. That's been happening ever since the first human society existed. Every civilization has faced this, and most civilizations, in fact, have collapsed because of their inability to respond to the ecological dilemma. Next slide. Well, there are only so many possible kinds of responses to this. You can move elsewhere to find unexploited resources. You can exploit existing resources more intensively. You can find new kinds of resources like uranium. Nobody ever thought to exploit uranium before. But all three of these are supply-side responses to the ecological dilemma. And our genius as humans is that we have been able to deploy these supply-side solutions in ever-expanding, ever-proliferating kinds of ways, and particularly since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but really going clear back to our harnessing of fire tens of thousands of years ago. We've gotten so good at the supply side solution that it's hard for us even to contemplate the demand side solution. Other species, when they confront the ecological dilemma, usually are forced to adopt sooner or later the demand side solutions. Simply limiting population, limiting per capita resource use. If nothing else works, the species dies off. When I give my talk to groups of economists or engineers, typically all they want to hear about, all they want to contemplate are supply-side solutions. Okay, it's an energy crisis, you know, we're running out of fossil fuels, so let's find alternative sources of energy. And these are very bright people, and I spoke recently at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, national laboratories, as you can imagine, you know, all of these incredibly bright engineers. Every one of them had an idea for a new supply-side solution. Well, you know, I'm not that interested in supply-side solutions. I'm sure we'll come up with very clever things. But unless we deploy demand-side solutions, we are going to hit the wall one way or another, sooner or later, because fossil fuel depletion is just the first, well, maybe not the first, but the most extreme symptom of this ecological dilemma. We're seeing essentially the same thing happen with fresh water, with fish in the oceans, with global climate, on and on, amphibians, species, loss of species diversity. So really, this is what I'm interested in talking about. And I have to say, that's virtually all I'm interested in talking about. We have to find a way of making a smaller footprint on this planet, of using fewer resources and more slowly and parsimoniously, of reducing our numbers, reducing the numbers of human beings on this planet. I'm not talking about killing off millions of people. I'm talking about reducing the human birth rate to the point where, over time, we have reduced our numbers to the point where we are within the long-term carrying capacity of planet Earth. Now, what is the long-term carrying capacity of Earth for humans? Nobody knows. But a good first guess would be how many people were on Earth before the Industrial Revolution? About 1 billion. How many of us are there now? About 6.4 billion. So there are probably about 5 billion people who are alive today only because of fossil fuels. That's a sobering thought. Again, we have to find our way peacefully, amicably, cooperatively down this precarious ramp. Next slide. One way of doing this would be by implementing some serious international agreements, such as this one that's been proposed, the Uppsala Protocol, which basically would simply limit oil exports and oil imports so as to undercut profiteering, undercut competition for the remaining resources. We have to cooperate, cooperate or die. Now, I think the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world is willing to contemplate these kinds of extraordinary measures. Most of the rest of the world has signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, after all. It's really just this country that is standing in the way. But unless the world's foremost oil-consuming nation is willing to sign on to an agreement like this, it's not going to happen. There is no single magic elixir or quick fix to any of this. I don't even like using the word solution because, you know, there are some problems that have solutions, like balancing your checkbook. You know, your checkbook's out of balance. Well, you can spend 5 minutes or 5 hours, whatever it takes, and at the end of the day, your checkbook will be balanced and that problem will be solved. There are other problems in human life that don't have solutions, like aging, you know, getting older. You can do that in better ways or worse ways, but you can't just make the problem go away. Similarly, with what we're facing now with fossil fuel depletion, there's no solution to global oil peak, fossil fuel depletion, and so on. There's nothing we can do to just make the problem go away, but there definitely are things that we can do that will be more intelligent responses. And there are responses that will be extremely unintelligent, I think. The most intelligent ones will be to aim for maximum efficiency with whatever we need to do, localize and decentralize our economies, take the movie of globalization we've been living in for the last 20 years and run that movie in reverse. Use alternatives now before the marketplace tells us that it's cost effective to do so, because we need to have those alternatives in place, if at all possible, before the hits the fan. You simply use less. Contract our expectations rather than expanding them. You know, right now we have the world's foremost propaganda system in place here in this country. We spend $225 billion a year on a propaganda system to tell us to buy and use and consume and waste more every year. It's called the U.S. advertising industry. We need exactly the opposite message. We need people to understand that they need to use less. Economic contraction. It's not going to be easy, but that's the direction we need to go. And finally, we need to raise awareness and talk about the issue, because if people don't understand what's at stake, if they don't understand what's happening to them, then our so-called leaders are simply going to dangle scapegoats in front of people's eyes and say, well, it's all because of some nasty people on the other side of the planet who are withholding our oil that just happens to be under their sands. And all we have to do is go over and bomb them and everything will be okay. Well, it's not going to be okay. But if people understand what's happening, then there's a willingness, then there may be a willingness for politicians at some point to follow. If the people lead, perhaps the leaders will follow. If there's a groundswell of understanding, then the leaders may feel that they have enough support to be able to say some things that people would otherwise not want to hear. I've spoken with several politicians, our local member of the House of Representatives, who's a member of the Energy Subcommittee of the U.S. House. I've given her my PowerPoint presentation. We've stood on the same stage together and talked about energy issues. But she doesn't talk about peak oil because she knows that it's just too scary, right? Well, if people start understanding this issue, maybe my representative, maybe yours, maybe politicians of all stripes will begin to be able to start talking about this and do something about it. Next slide. We need, in the meantime, we need to also ensure local food security. Don't depend upon food from 1,500 miles away. Don't assume that that food is always going to be there. Who are your local farmers? Ensure local water security. Reduce your need for transportation personally and as a community. What infrastructure can you put in place to reduce the need for transportation? How about car co-ops, for example? Support your local economy. You know, Walmart is soon going to be a thing of the past because all of that imported stuff from China is going to just simply cost too much to import. However, in the meantime, all of these huge big box chains will have destroyed the local infrastructure, local economic infrastructure of small towns all across America, and it's already largely happened. We've got to stop that process. We have to foster the local manufacturing of essential goods for local consumption. Who makes shoes around here? Who makes clothing? You know, what do we really need? Think about that. What skills can you bring to your local community? What necessary skills can you offer your neighbors? And finally, we need to plan for long-term emergency services. Most of our emergency services are planned only for very short-term emergencies, and we are facing probably a decades-long emergency over going forward with peak oil and the succeeding events. So, next slide, please. Okay, this is how you can contact me if you want. This is all rather sobering, isn't it? Yes, okay. It would be nice if none of this were true. And if I'm wrong about any of this or all of it, great. I'd be happy to be proven wrong, quite frankly. But if this is right, if this is true, then we are facing the greatest challenge of our lifetimes. And anything that we can do to prepare for this, anything that we can do to knit together our local economic infrastructure, anything that we can do to support each other through this process of transition will be extremely meaningful, not only for ourselves, but also for the next generation and the generation after that. Because quite frankly, if we don't do some of these things, if we don't respond intelligently, there may not be a generation after that. It's that important. Thank you very much for your attention this evening. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Richard Heinberg speaking November 12th at the first U.S. Conference on Peak Oil and Community Solutions. A question period followed his talk.
Do I think a slow economic collapse or contraction is possible? And if so, do I think that's preferable over a quick economic collapse? Well, if I were looking at this not from the standpoint of a human being, but from the standpoint of a sea otter, I might scratch my head and go, well, maybe quick collapse would be, the sooner these people are gone, the better off we'll all be. With a quick economic collapse, I think the likelihood of global nuclear war is dramatically increased. Slow economic contraction, I think, is very unlikely. However, on the other hand, we have to look back to the one historical precedent we have, which is the early 1970s, pretty much as a whole. As a result of the oil embargo, higher oil prices, oil consumption declined, and we saw actually some economic contraction. And we managed to make it through that pretty well. We increased our energy efficiency pretty dramatically. That suggests to me that it would be possible for us to have maybe a dozen years of slow economic contraction without real extraordinary hardship. And if we weathered that well, if we designed as we went along, then I think we might be able to do what Cuba has done. And by contracting gradually, end up with simply a low energy, steady state economy. And that would be the ideal. That's where that would be my first preference. It's not going to be easy or simple, but that would be my first preference. First and then second. Am I acquainted with the permaculture people? Very much so, yes. Absolutely. Permaculture is wonderful, and we will be talking about it a lot this weekend. As a matter of fact, David Holmgren, who is one of the originators of the whole permaculture idea, came out with a book just a couple of years ago, which talks a great deal about peak oil. And he says in the book that from the very beginning, he and Bill Mollison envisioned permaculture as a response to the inevitable end of the age of fossil fuels. Yes. What was the role of 9/11 in all of this, and what do we do with Bush? Oh, how I wish I had an easy answer to that. We're looking at, I think, one of history's great tragedies playing out here. If ever there was a time in human history when deft, intelligent leadership was needed, now is such a time. And what we have in its place hardly bears description. 9/11, in my view, was a facilitated event. I don't doubt that it was accomplished as a result of a plot of foreign terrorists, but I believe also that it was that plot was very early on intercepted, understood, and permitted to happen, and that in fact deliberate aid was given on the part of by members of the administration. So it was in effect as my friend David Ray Griffin calls it, a new Pearl Harbor. It was an excuse then to launch the new resource wars, first in Afghanistan, Iraq, and soon, I'm afraid, likely to be in Iran and other countries as well. He's asking, what should we look for as signs of peak oil in our daily life? I think we're seeing them all around us, really, that the steepening prices of oil, the evaporation of spare production capacity, the increasing competition between U.S. and China for long-term contracts from Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and Central Asia, all of these things, these things would not be happening if we weren't approaching peak oil, if we weren't within probably a year to 18 months to maybe 24 months of global oil production peak. I'd say we're likely to see oil prices increase in a volatile way over the next 18 months or so. In other words, we'll see another spike, and then the economy will start to reel as a result of high energy prices. That will kill some demand, and as a result of demand destruction, oil prices will go back down for a few months, and then they'll achieve new heights. But if you look at the graph and average it out, it will be a steepening increase in oil and natural gas costs. I think we're likely to see more large-scale blackouts like we had on August 13th of last year because of natural gas shortages in this country. This winter, we are riding on the question of good or bad weather. If it's good weather, we'll get through the winter okay. If it's bad weather, we'll run short of heating oil and possibly of natural gas as well. Next winter, we're almost certain to experience natural gas shortages and probably heating oil shortages unless we just have extraordinarily warm weather. So that's the kind of thing that we're going to have to get used to as time goes on. Could we have a question from a woman, please? Where any female would like to have a gender balance here? Yes, please. The question is about corporate strategies. Don't they see this coming? And shouldn't they be investing in renewables and efficiency and so on? It's a complicated situation. First of all, many, not all, but many of the oil companies are themselves in kind of a state of denial about all of this because the people who are running the show, the people in the front office who make the decisions are economists rather than petroleum geologists. If you look at the people who are actually doing the work, the geologists, they understand all of this very well. And I hear from them pretty frequently by email, but the people who are actually making the investment decisions and running the corporation don't understand all of this. They're schooled in economic theory, which basically says resource depletion is almost impossible to occur by definition. That sounds insane, but if you look at modern economic theory, that's essentially what it says. secondly, some of the some of the oil companies are investing in alternatives in a kind of tepid way. Shell, BP, they both have solar divisions. In fact, most of the solar panel manufacturing going on right now is being done by oil companies. There's some exceptions. Sharp in Japan is a big solar manufacturer. but also, you know, looking at it from their standpoint, oil production peak, if they manage it right, is the biggest business opportunity in history. Because right now, it doesn't cost them that much more to extract oil than it did 6 months ago, but they're getting twice as much money for it. Now, that doesn't sound so bad from their point of view. You know, who cares if it starts to become a little more scarce? Who cares if their reserves are declining? If, in fact, for every dollar of investment, they're making, you know, 10 times more in the way of return. So from their standpoint, I don't see huge incentives yet for them to diversify that strenuously. Number one and two, yes? What about oil becoming utility so that oil extraction refining and distribution is under the umbrella of a government commission rather than corporate controlled? That would be a good idea. I think we actually need something like that, and that's also the point of the Uppsala Protocol on a global level, is to take it out of the hands of simply of the market, because the market cannot handle what is coming. We are going to desperately need government intervention in the market in order to make it through this energy famine, which is essentially what we're facing. So yes, I think that's an excellent suggestion. And the question is about storage of energy. Right now, solar and wind depend a lot on battery technology, and batteries are inherently unsustainable. You have to replace them every few years and so on. Yes, and that's yet another reason to look more at demand-side solutions rather than supply-side solutions. There are other energy storage technologies being developed, even something as simple and I don't know what other adjective to use, but flywheel, just pumping energy into a big flywheel that's in a vacuum, and then drawing the energy back off. It turns out that's a relatively efficient means of energy storage. And there are others, but primarily, you know, we really need to look at demand side solutions. One and two. Yeah, I'm not sure I can repeat that question, but it has to do with the U.S. empire peaking, in a sense, because of a global oil peak. This is a whole talk in and of itself. the U.S. empire is extraordinarily overextended and is on the verge of collapse. And that, I think, is part of what's making its masters that much more irrational and arrogant. Well, look at the situation. Where is the oil? It's in Eurasia, most of it. Over 70% of it, probably 75% of it. Central Asia, Middle East, Russia. And who's contending for that oil? Russia, China, Europe, and the US, primary users, and Japan. Well, we have to send boatloads of armies and weapons halfway across the world to fight for the stuff, which costs immense amounts of money that bankrupts our economy. And then when we get it, we have to transport it back using oil tankers that are extremely vulnerable to all kinds of sabotage and military technologies and so on. And who are we fighting? We're fighting people who are right there in Eurasia. Again, Russia, China, Europe. We're not fighting Europe. We're not fighting any of these people. But ultimately, these are the people that we are competing with for control of these resources. It's a losing proposition. The U.S. cannot win the game of global domination. Somebody else was number two. Yes.
See if I can pull this together. I think that over my years of taking a socio-psychological anthropological view, or at least trying to, I have some real questions about whether enough people can wake up from the trance. I've just as a woman past the 50th year of life, I think, is there enough mass sanity amongst us humans? And how the hell do you estimate peak sanity?
Well, you know, it is easy to get a little pessimistic about all of this. And, you know, I've had the remarkable experience over the past few months of seeing my audiences start to get more pessimistic than I am, which is really scary. But I would have to say it's a great tonic to get outside this country and see the rest of the world, because when you're in this country and reading the papers and seeing what our leaders are doing, it's pretty easy to think, you know, there's no way in hell we're going to make our way out of this without global nuclear war. These people are just too crazy, and the people I see around me driving the SUVs, they're not going to, you know, you'll have to pry their fingers off the steering wheel, you know. But you travel elsewhere in the world, and the story is very different. I mean, people in Europe are already using energy at one half the per capita rate of us Americans. And then you travel elsewhere from there into the third world, and you see that there are people happily, cooperatively living low energy lifestyles right now. So can we do it as a species? I don't know, but are we capable of doing it in theory? Well, yes, I can say with confidence that we are, because we're already doing it in a million different places. Maybe just one more question. Back there, where? Okay, go ahead. I don't see
yeah.
you.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Well, I think all of them are good ideas. I think all of them need to be thought through more thoroughly. And we all need to be doing that. We all need to be engaged in that process. These are good first approximations. They're good first suggestions. Okay? Yes, let's get on board with them. And when we go home, you know, we can't imagine that by endorsing some proposed solution that thereby, you know, the battle is won, the problem is solved, we can go on with our daily life. It's going to be a huge, huge effort, even once we're all on the same page with one or another of these proposals, or still another one that maybe is you know, the next generation approximation of what's needed. It's going to be a huge haul between then and actually accomplishing it. Again, we're talking about trillions of dollars of investment and many, many years of very hard work and sacrifice on the part of all of us and our friends and neighbors and people around the world. It's not going to be easy. We shouldn't kid ourselves that it is. But what's the alternative? Okay? So we have our work cut out for us. Great to be with you in doing it. Thank you.
And you were listening to Richard Heinberg in discussion with participants at the first U.S. conference on peak oil and community solutions earlier this month. Next week, more presentations from the conference. To join the work to find community solutions in the Finger Lakes region, subscribe to the Finger Lakes Peak Oil listserv by sending a message to FOIL, F-O-I-L, at lists.riseup.net, or just write me at lynn@ithacaradio.org, L-Y-N, @ithacaradio.org. Thanks to Peter Arena, Megan Quinn, Faith Morgan, Pat Murphy, and Community Solutions for their assistance in the recording of conference audio. One recurring theme in the information presented at the conference was the way powerful corporations throughout American history have dictated social and economic policies and systems that benefit their bottom lines to the detriment of people and planet. In America, while normally there is an attempt to maintain the veneer of democracy, nevertheless, as the following material will show, these corporate elites are prepared to do whatever is necessary to prevent challenges to their dominance. Pokey Anderson, co-host of a wonderful program called Sunday Monitor, which is heard on Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, discovered some archival tape recorded 15 years ago about a little-known historical incident, a plot by a group of American capitalists to overthrow the FDR administration and install fascism.
I'm Bob DeBolt, and I'm interviewing Jules Archer, who has published over 1,000 articles and 75 books.
I think controversy is very important. What was your one of the more controversial books that you've published?
Well, it's a book that made me a knight of Mark Twain. There's a magazine put out by Clemens's grandson. He made me a knight of this organization because of a valuable contribution American history had never been written before. And that was a book called The Plot to Seize the White House. That sounds like fiction, or it sounds like the Watergate, but it wasn't. What it was an actual plot by some of the richest corporations and millionaires in this country to take over the United States government in a fascist march on Washington and seize power and use, it was against Roosevelt, whom they considered a communist at the time, and use him as a puppet. And if he wouldn't be a puppet, as King Emmanuel was made a puppet by Mussolini, then they would just remove him, say he was unfit, he was too sick to reign, and they would take over and make a fascist America. These conspirators, who numbered, as I say, the major corporations in the United States, went to General Smedley Butler, who was the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, who had been twice decorated with the Medal of Honor by Congress, and wanted him to be the man on the white horse. And they were ready to raise a paramilitary army of 500,000 men. they were prepared to provide them all with arms, and he was to take his orders and march on Washington to stage this coup. Butler, who was a terrific general, the reason they went to him was because they wanted MacArthur, but MacArthur had been discredited by the bonus march. The veterans wouldn't have anything to do with him because he had marched against the veterans on the bonus march. So they thought, well, Smedley Butler has the greatest respect of any of the brass in the armed forces. And they just counted on his being gullible enough to fall for their scheme. Instead, Butler was a very dedicated American, and he listened to them. First he couldn't believe what he was hearing, and then he decided to play along and find out the whole extent of the plot. And then he needed verification. So he got a reporter from the Philadelphia Record who went to see them also, and the record, and supposedly implying that Butler would consent and that he was going to assist Butler. And they spilled even more beans, which was verification of the plot. Then Butler went to the McCormick-Dickstein Committee of the House of Representatives. At that time, McCormick was the head of that committee. It was the basis for the House Un-American Activities Committee, but not the way it later developed. It was supposed to investigate both fascist and communist activities in America. And McCormick heard this testimony, and he revealed it to the press, and they were going to hold hearings in which it would all be aired. At first, the media ridiculed the whole thing. It seemed like a bizarre idea, really far out. But then, when the hearings were held and Butler testified, and the reporter from the Philadelphia Record reconfirmed everything, and McCormick's men and investigators checked everything and said everything General Butler said was absolutely true, this organization, which was at that time called the American Liberty League, folded its tents and silently stole away, simply saying, well, our purposes have been accomplished. They claimed that what they were there was to preserve the Constitution. That was their purpose, and they were going to do this by the March on Washington, which, of course, was not part of their public plan. So as a result of this, an interesting thing developed. Butler was vindicated. The plot was exposed. And yet, had it not been exposed, had Butler been willing to play along as the man in the white horse, there's no doubt they could have achieved their objective. And if they had taken over the White House as a fascist, and we became a fascist government, guess which side we would have been on in World War II, which would have changed today. All of us could be hiring Hitler in our living rooms, except for the fact that General Smedley Butler was a genuine patriot. And on the other hand, you will not find one mention of this in any school book. And when this was on a previous broadcast in the university, when I mentioned this, our university students called in and were gassed that they'd never heard anything like this in their lives. Of course they didn't. But it's factual, and you can get the Congressional Committee report, which has all these facts in it, to verify it. Butler did more than expose the plot to seize the White House. When he retired, he also made some honest statements which were unlike any statements ever made by a top military leader in this country. And this is what Butler said. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I suspected I was just part of a racket at the time. Now I'm sure of it. Thus, I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the national bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. The record is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China in 1927, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. During those years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. I was reported with honors, medals, and promotion. Looking back on it, I think that I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate his racket in 3 city districts. I operated on 3 continents. By the way, on that, I should say that I talked to, who was it now? One of the generals, a famous American general, who served with Butler in China. Butler at the time told, he told me that Butler had said to him, you know, they sent us here to protect Standard Oil interests. That's why these guys are risking their lives here. And this general said to me, I doubted that the government would do a thing like that, but now I'm positive of it.
And Shoup said, I believe that if we had and would keep our dirty, bloody, dollar-soaked fingers out of the business of these nations so full of depressed, exploited people, they will arrive at a solution of their own, and if, unfortunately, their revolution must be of the violent type, because the haves refuse to share with the have-nots by any peaceful method, at least what they get will be their own, and not the American style, which they don't want, and above all, don't want crammed down their throats by Americans. He was also the winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor.
That last quote you just heard was General Shoup, who served with Butler all over the place. Just a few more notes of the tone of the era. What with the crash of the stock market in 1929, there was a lot of blame going around, and quite frankly, the wealthy were not used to getting blamed for anything. They were kind of shocked, and so they were kind of going, wait a minute, we don't want it. Let's find somebody else to blame. There was a lot of anti-union bashing, literally bashing going on, and there were extravagant charges against President Roosevelt, including he was called everything: a communist, a socialist, a Marxist, a red, a fascist, a syphilitic, an alcoholic, a liar, a renegade, destructive, and a dictator. All of those were things that FDR was called. And in fact, in one case, the charges accused Roosevelt of seeking to abolish marriage and religion. So even though he's a pretty popular guy now, in most places, he wasn't real popular then. Let's go back to hear what else Jules Archer has to tell about the story.
Well, I talked to Speaker of the House McCormick, who was at the time, he was the head of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, which was investigating the situation. And after his investigation of all the allegations, he said that this was a plot to turn America fascist, and actually it would have succeeded except for the fact that the plotters chose the wrong man to lead the revolution, somebody they thought they could con and control. It was the Pews, the DuPonts, I'm trying to recall now, the General Motors, and Remington Arms was involved. These plotters, one of the plotters was the heir of the Singer sewing machine, for a multimillionaire who was providing money to get this thing rolling. And the arms manufacturers and the chemical companies were providing the arms for the paramilitary army, and the others were providing money and prestige. They organized together in something called the Liberty League, which was supposedly to protect the Constitution. And this was the mask they were going to use for their whole project. And one of their front men actually told a reporter in private, of a reporter he thought he could trust, that the American people were so dumb that they would accept what was being done to turn America fascist under the guise of protecting the Constitution. And they intended to say that Roosevelt, who everybody knew was stricken with polio, was too ill to rule a country, and therefore they were going to give him an assistant president, who of course would be the dictator. First, they wanted Smedley Butler to march with his paramilitary army, take over the country, and then say it was done to save the Constitution, and they would have the assistant president who would, if Roosevelt went along, he would be allowed to remain as a puppet. If he refused to go along, they would get rid of him. Butler went before the McCormick-Dickstein Committee to reveal the plot. Time magazine and most of the media immediately ridiculed it, and in the front page of the Times, they had a story after making it seem that Butler was off his nut, that he was a kook. And then about a couple of months later, after the McCormick-Dickstein Committee had checked out and investigated the story, and they reported it was 100% validated, it was all true, Time magazine noted this on page 44 in four-point type footnote, four lines at the bottom of a page in four-point type. And that is the kind of treatment that this received, and it is the explanation of why you don't find it in the history books today, and why no schoolboy, even very few college students, are aware of the serious plot which failed. But here was something that happened, a coup that failed in the United States, and nobody knows about it.
The wealthy people of the time were J.P. Morgan and his concerns, the Pews, and they were in Sun Oil. You may have heard of the Pew Charitable Trust. The Mellons and the Pitcairns were among the wealthiest families in the country at that time. Richard Mellon, according to a book called Hoods and Shirts, said, quote, "You can't run a coal mine without machine guns." A couple of things that really incurred the wrath of the DuPonts and the Morgans. One, there was rumors that there was going to be a Senate investigation into the munitions industry's role in speeding America's entry into World War I. And the DuPonts were the leading armament producers in the world at that time, with the nickname Merchants of Death, because they'd already made huge profits during the Civil War and the War of 1812. Also, alarming the big financiers, the passage of the Securities Act of 1933 and 1934, and that established the SEC. So they were pretty upset about what was going on. Some of the other names that Smedley Butler urged the committee that was investigating to question included a partner in J.P. Morgan named Grayson Murphy, the former governor of Massachusetts, Joseph Ely, John W. Davis, Alfred E. Smith, who had run for president on the Democratic ticket, General Hugh Johnson, and Thomas Lamont, another partner at J.P. Morgan. Douglas MacArthur's name came up as a potential leader of the country or as a military leader when it was feared that Smedley Butler wouldn't do it. A journalist who talked with the messenger who had talked with General Butler said that he had gone over to Europe and he had seen, this is a quote of what the journalist told the committee, what he had seen in Europe. It was a plan that Hitler had used in putting all of the unemployed in labor camps or barracks in forced labor. That would solve it overnight, and he said that when they got into power, that is what they would do. That was the ideal plan. He had another suggestion to register all people all over the country. He said that would stop a lot of these communist agitators who were running around the country. And then according to the Philadelphia Record, the same people who succeeded in slashing aid to veterans would use those veterans as their pawns in a war on democracy. The folks who want fascism in this country are the same folk who made profit while others bled and who would rather see the veterans starve than add to the burden of taxes on great wealth. And we'll close out with Smedley Butler, who in his book, War is a Racket, suggested that if all steel makers, munitions makers, and bankers got the same pay as fighting soldiers, after 30 days, he said, there will be no more war.
Thanks to Pokey Anderson for that audio. And I encourage you to listen to Sunday Monitor online at 6 p.m. Central Time on Sundays at kpftx.org. Thanks for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.